They say that owners come to resemble their dogs. Or is it the other way round? I wouldn't know, never having owned a dog, not wishing to inflict my face on one. But an even more unlikely proposition, that books come to resemble their authors, does strike me as having some validity. In front of me, I have first editions of two novels, one published in 1928 and one in 1930, in brightly colored dust wrappers, with amusing, cartoon-like illustrations on the covers, witty but childlike, distinctly chirpy. They're clearly intended to transmit something not only about the contents of the book, but about its author. That becomes obvious when you realize that this author designed them himself. The first of these books is Decline and Fall, the second, Vile Bodies. Their author was Evelyn Waugh, and the very appearance of the books nominates him as a bright young thing of the 1920s. And how different is this third book? Published in 1944, severely bound in stiff blue-gray paper wrappers, with a simple label affixed, giving its title, Brideshead Revisited, and the name of the author, the selfsame Evelyn Waugh. The change from the brightness of tone and appearance of Waugh's early books to the somber color of Brideshead suggests, of course, something more than a change in the author's nature and self-presentation. Brideshead was published at the end of World War II and is, in part, a chronicle of the loss of innocence of a generation of young people who, having escaped the horrors of the trenches, had their relatively short and superficial period of gaiety brutally truncated by the events of the Second War. This unprepossessing volume was intended as a Christmas gift and was published in an edition of just 50 copies. It bears an inserted sticker which announces, in the strictest tones, "This edition is privately printed for the author's friends. No copies are for sale. Messrs. Chapman and Hall earnestly request that until they announce the publication of the ordinary edition, in the early part of 1945, copies will not be lent outside the circle for which they are intended, and no reference will appear to the book in the press." It isn't clear in the rare book trade what this limited edition of Brideshead should be called. I've seen it referred to as a proof copy, which it is not, because proof copies are cheaply printed by publishers for editorial and marketing purposes. Nor is it a pre-publication issue, though it does precede the ordinary edition, which was published in 1945. What this is, quite simply, is the first edition of Brideshead Revisited, and it is, as you would imagine, distinctly scarce. I've owned a couple of copies in my time, all of them inscribed by Waugh to one chum or another, but by far the best was that given to Graham Greene. It was sometime in 1989, I think, that I had a phone call from him. He told me, in that slightly puckish tone that he liked to adopt, that he had a copy of Brideshead with a little dedicas from Evelyn to me. Might I be interested in buying it? Distinctly, I said, distinctly. Oh, good, he replied, as if I'd surprised him. He was a lot of fun to deal with. I could give you £6,000 for it, I said. It was important to sound as if I knew what it was worth, but in fact valuing a book of this sort is difficult, because it's unique. Other inscribed copies of the same issue had fetched less, but this one, being inscribed to Green, was more desirable. He didn't pause for thought. That'll be fine. I'll have the book sent round to you. It's hard for me to price a book until I have it in my hands. It's a matter of acquaintance, of look and feel. I price a book with my fingers and my eyes. When the Brideshead arrived in lovely condition with its simple but perfect inscription, "For Graham Greene, this antiquated work from Evelyn Waugh," I fell in love with it immediately, and with every day that passed, I loved it more and more, and it got more and more expensive. I'd begun by thinking I might get £10,000 for it, a reasonable profit, but as soon as I saw it, it went up to £12,000. Over the next few weeks, I kept raising the price as if the book had a taximeter attached to it, whirling round and round. I eventually sold it for $16,000 to another bookseller. He didn't hesitate, leaving me with the unhappy impression that he might have paid more. If I ever write a book of memoirs of my life as a bookseller, it will be entitled, "If It Sold, It must have been too cheap. But before selling the book, I did ring Graham to tell him of my revised estimate of the book's value, promising him a further substantial check when the book sold. "Not at all," he said. "When we agree a price, that means I'm happy with what I'm getting. If you do well out of it, then good for you." So worldly, so generous, so wise. But he was also content, because he had another copy of the book, that issued as the first ordinary edition in 1945, with a similarly charming dedicace. I offered to buy that as well, but that was going too far. "It's one of my favorite books," he said, a little acerbically, "and I intend to reread it." I toyed with the idea of sending him a Penguin copy to reread, but decided against it.
I, for one, was inclined to dismiss Brideshead Revisited, which many people have considered his best book. He had written to me, but the only excuse for it was Nissenhuts and spam and the blackout. And I accepted that criticism until the other day when I reread the book and, to my astonishment, joined the ranks of those who find it his best, even though it is also his most romantic.
Brideshead Revisited was begun in 1943, but War was unable to get a sustained run at the manuscript, working on it between various missions and tours of duty, particularly in Yugoslavia and Italy. He had a relatively peaceful war, much of it spent swanning about with various pals in foreign parts, trying to find congenial company and decent food. Irascible at the best of times, he was not exactly a model soldier. One of his postings ended within 24 hours, when, after being rebuked by his commanding officer for drunkenness, Waugh informed him that he did not see why he should change the habits of a lifetime for a whim of his. He'd already spilled a glass of claret into the officer's lap. It's no wonder, then, that when he applied to the War Office for indefinite leave to work on his novel, his superiors were astonished, but agreed. I rather suspect that they were as happy to have a rest from him as he was from them, and novel writing, after all, was what he was best at. Though he was eventually recalled to active service, work on the novel progressed steadily, and he finished it in June of 1944. And he was uncharacteristically pleased with the result. Brideshead was, he believed, his masterpiece, a spiritually grounded work filled with what he called hope, not indeed that anything but disaster lies ahead, but that the human spirit, redeemed, can survive all disasters. Once finished, the book was quickly typeset, bound at War's expense, and the limited edition sent as a Christmas present. It was a nice traditional gift, a somber, rather old-fashioned book. War despised artistic modernism.
"Well, I don't like very many modern novelists, you know, but I'm awfully shocked by what seems to me slovenly work. It's always true that a writer has to modify truth to make it plausible. When I began writing, it was a great period of shock. But there was a much more sinister influence, which was to try and reduce prose style to gibberish. What Mr. Cyril Connolly has called the breakthrough was in fact the breakup in painting, architecture, and poetry, in which the common man has a certain feeling of awe, so he's prepared to be bamboozled. They accepted what was offered. But when it came to prose, the English common man knows what prose is. He talks it all the time himself, and he wasn't going to be taken in. And there are a lot of Americans, headed by Gertrude Stein, who wrote absolute gibberish. Then they hired a poor dotty Irishman called James Joyce, thought to be a great influence in my youth. He wrote absolute rot. He began writing quite well, and you could see him going mad sentence by sentence. If you read Ulysses, it's perfectly sane for a little bit, and then it goes madder and madder. And then they hired him to write Finnegan's Wake, which is gibberish."
If Waugh had intended the gift of Brideshead as a proverbial gift horse, it was the job of his friends to look it in the mouth. Like most writers, he solicited criticism and was unduly sensitive when it came. He was most grateful for corrections with regard to matters of fact, as when Father Ronald Knox assisted with details about the consecrations of chapels. Nancy Mitford, who had the good sense first to proclaim the book a classic, helped him on a question of fashion. Diamond clips, she informed him regally, were only invented about 1930, and what he had worn was a diamond arrow. He was more anxious about responses to the book's relatively modest sexual explicitness. Catherine Asquith could hardly bring herself to read it, and his wife Laura was a little embarrassed by the relevant passages, and had the wit not to say so. In general, his Catholic friends were supportive. Graham Greene.
When I reread it, I was reading for the first time his revised copy, and he had modified passages which I had very much disliked. For example, when he is describing the passage of love between his hero and Julia on a cross-channel boat while his wife sleeps in another cabin, he wrote originally, "Now on the rough water I was made free of her white breast and narrow loins." I still think this a rather monstrous piece of romantic writing. But it has become much drier in the new version. It was as though a deed of conveyance of her narrow loins had been drawn and sealed. Perhaps, like the late James, Brideshead will always seem a little gamey, but all the same, it contains Evelyn at his best.
Waugh was sure that he had produced his best novel so far, and the public agreed. The book sold out immediately, though it was not reprinted, due to paper shortages. And Waugh's financial future was insured when the book was purchased by the American Book of the Month Club and sold 750,000 copies. He was even offered $150,000 for the film rights, a huge sum in those days, but eventually declined when he couldn't ensure adequate control of the script. The newly acquired riches didn't entirely suit Waugh. He could indulge his taste for buying grand houses, collecting Victoriana, and stocking his cellar, but he missed the anxiety of having to write for money. It sharpened his mind and his appetites. In latter years, his temper shortened, his snobbery increased, his misanthropy deepened. But according to his son, the late Oberon Waugh, he was really more a depressive than a bully.
What made him daunting was his moods. He was a very moody man, and so one had to be careful of him. But he wasn't at all the sort of bad-tempered ogre he's been painted. He's rather gentle, but a melancholic man more than anything else. And what was frightening about him was the thought that if one put a foot wrong, he might go into a sort of melancholy.
As he aged, Waugh's books, too, changed in appearance, like a master and his dog going grey together. None of the later books visually have any of the earlier gaiety about them. They're frumpy and tired. None of them have even that solemn austerity suggested by the first edition of Brideshead Revisited.